The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Well, we're making a difference here, too. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. I'm the author of the blog newsdissector.com, which is an effort to monitor news and information, offer another perspective when one is available, to try to debate not just the news, but news coverage. And every week at this time, we're here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com offering a audio version of the blog, talking to you about issues that you think are important. You can call us on our call-in line at 888-874-4888. That number again, it's a free call, 888-874-4888. This has been a tumultuous week, as many of these past weeks have been, not only in terms of the heat, which seems to be driving up the cost of food because of food failures in many parts of the world. I don't know if you've read this today, but consumers can expect to see a jump in prices for pasta, meat, vegetable oil, and many other grocery items in the coming months because of the brutal heat that we've been experiencing, the drought and flooding that has taken a toll on corn, soybeans, and wheat grown on American farms. But do not in any way connect this to the climate crisis. Do not in any way think that the extreme heat that we've been having and the weird weather that we've been having is in any way linked to this deeper problem of climate change. Just keep telling yourself that. I'm sure it'll make you a lot happier. Anyway, we're going to be talking about the economy. We're going to be talking about the zigzagging of the markets, which are extremely tumultuous. As you know, they were down, now they're up, now they're down. Clearly, the economy is in deep doo-doo, and Max Wolf, the economist from the New School and who also works on Wall Street, is going to be joining us at 1:30 to give us a perspective on what's happening on that front, which is extremely important and will affect us all. The whole debate over whether or not inflation is a bad deal, what Paul Krugman is writing today and almost every day, namely that we have to do something to stimulate the economy. You know, he makes the point today, says if you go to a hospital and you're bleeding, you want a doctor to mend your wound right there on the spot. You don't want to get a lecture on, you know, that you should eat more vegetables and, you know, about sustainable diets. You need to be attended to. And he's saying we're in an economic emergency, a jobs crisis, unemployment, you know, remaining very high, and of course many people no longer even seeking jobs or filing for benefits because they're that discouraged and that depressed about the whole thing. So we're in a situation that's extremely urgent and often not discussed, and there's been some fight back on it. A woman last week flew a plane over Wall Street with a sign that said, "You all should be fired." A mom sent that message. Other people are trying to kind of fight back against all of this. There is going to be a protest on Wall Street in September, which we'll tell you more about today. Down in the Wall Street area, there's going to be a protest against the Fed. If you can open up Kat's mic here, can you just tell us where that's going to be and what's happening today?
Oh, hey, Dan. It's 33 Liberty Street at the New York City Federal Reserve Bank from 4 to 6 p.m. today.
Okay, 33. So, just that's not the New York City. It's the Federal Reserve Bank in New York City, right, formerly run by Tim Geithner. But so protests against the Fed continue and its role, shadowy role, pumping trillions of dollars into the economy. When everybody else in Congress says, we don't want to stimulate the economy, the Fed has jumped in to do so by printing money, because otherwise what we've seen as a crash is going to be child's play compared to what we're going to be seeing. We have a guest in London who's going to be joining us in a second. We're talking about the uprisings that have taken place in England this past week, an amazing story of young people in revolt, fighting in the streets, looting and some killing of people, apparently an accident, and a British government now that is in a totally punitive mode. It's not interested in the causes, but more in the consequences or meting out consequences to the people who've been arrested for on the scene live. But there's nothing happening right now. But Bill Bowles, who lived in New York for many years, who writes a terrific blog and analysis at williambowles.info, is with us from London. We'll hear from him in a second. But first, to set the scene, and this is something John Stewart mentioned, you know, when the riots took place, he says, has the Clash gotten back together? The Clash! London has been calling all week. London has been burning all week. It's a new battle of Britain. And what actually caused it is really not something we read much about. We're reading about fires burning and policemen being attacked. But the causes of this particular revolt have been, you know, not a subject of great investigation by either the British press or the American press. So, Bill Bowles, give us an update on what's happening now, and let's get into a little discussion of how this whole thing kind of rolled out.
Hey there, Danny. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, we do.
Good. Well, I mean, from what I can see from the very beginning, it's clear that the shooting of Mark Duggan was just simply a trigger, a catalyst for a whole lot of stuff which has been building up like a giant boil underneath the surface of this society, and to the point at which it just exploded. There's no other description that one can give it as except a complete explosion out of what? Desperation? I don't know. But clearly things have been building and building and building. And even though, and this is the amazing thing, even though the cuts that the Lib Tory coalition is implementing have not yet fully bitten, they won't do, and probably until next year, it's clear that the cuts that have already taken place were just, if you like, the straw that broke the camel's back.
Now, you're talking now about the austerity measures that the Cameron Conservative Tory government is saying they're going to continue, as much as 40% chop in cutting people who are barely making it as it is, it seems like. And
And
this new wave of austerity in the name of economic, you know, stability is actually creating a tremendous amount of social instability in England. It's interesting that the Chancellor of the Exchequer, you know, in basically defending all of this, avoided the defense of it and simply said, well, we still have our AAA rating, you know, haha, America, you know. In other words, any kind of way to divert away from actually talking about what's behind all of this. It's much easier, it seems, to demonize everybody as criminals, as I understand it, up in Tottenham in North London, when after this man was killed, people assembled peacefully at the police station, were protesting it. And then the cops came out and started cracking heads, which led to the reaction, which is what usually happens. It's a cycle. It's not a premeditated, you know, guerrilla-style attack usually. It's a combustion that leads to, you know, action-reaction.
I have my own theory about the way that, because I think what's critical here is how the state and the media, especially the media, responded to these events, which obviously, you know, the events in Tottenham over Mark Duggan were just simply the catalyst which triggered, literally, the way I could see, even at the bottom of my street, stores had their windows smashed in, just reacted, spreading like a wave right across the country. But I think what's important here is that, one, it to my way of looking at it, watching the videos on the news from the time that it happened and following it all the way through, it's clear that in the initial day, that first weekend, last weekend, my impression, and it wasn't just my impression, I don't think, although the reasons might differ, but it was my impression that the police deliberately held off from intervening. There was one report from a neighbourhood which is very close to me and I know quite well, Clapham Junction in South London, where an eyewitness, not somebody taking part in the looting and the burning, commented on the fact that a bunch of cops were standing, you know, several feet away from where guys were breaking into a department store. So, I mean, looking at that and the following nights that happened up until, today's Friday, so it would have been Wednesday when they brought the full force of the state down onto neighborhoods, was that they allowed it to go because, one, it enabled the state to demonize these people, and that followed. You had this incredible statement from Cameron, the Prime Minister, in the House of Commons yesterday, where he said, you know, in the beginning, the reason why the police didn't react is that we thought it was civil disorder. But the minute we realized that it was not civil disorder, but crime on, a national scale, pretty much, then we had to alter our tactics. So it's clear to me, anyway, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any sense, stretch of the imagination, I think it's clear to me that the government knew that sooner or later something like this would happen. They've written documents about it. The Department of Defense the Ministry of Defense have written documents about it, and so on, which I've quoted from several times, that they needed to, one, change this from a civil uprising into a criminal event. And the way the media played it, they went right along with it. So, for example, there was one video of a guy who'd been injured. I don't know by whom, but the camera was looking at this guy, and a bunch of kids, I assume, who were taking part in the looting and the burning, came up to him and robbed him. Okay, not a very nice thing to do. But the fact is that the TV showed this one clip over and over again. In other words, you know, they wanted to reinforce the idea that these are animals. And then you had that whole thing about calling them feral, which, you know, what does that do to so-called Middle England? People look at all this, and that's how they react. They react to these are a bunch of animals. So it's you know.
Could that be yeah. a deliberate, strategy of demonization for political gain by the Tories, who want to appear very tough here? Their economic policies are under, you know, criticism. The whole hacking scandal just took place that made them look quite complicit, if not totally stupid, you know, in the context of it all. Now, here's an issue you can grandstand on, the same way that Ronald Reagan did that, you know, maybe Maggie Thatcher as well, you know. Take the hard line, show how tough you are, and rally the people behind repressive policies, which seem to be in place.
Well, I mean, look, you know, the first riots that took place in Toxteth and Brixton, the same, not virtually the same neighborhoods that has occurred this time, back in 1980-81, was under Thatcher's rule, and it was precisely for the same, for very, very similar reasons that the riots occurred this time, and that is heavy-handed policing. If you look at the figures, you see that if you're black in England, you stand a 10 times more chance of being stopped by the police. The infamous sus laws, which were being able to stop anybody on the street without any reason, which were repealed after the riots of 1881, or the insurrection, I should say, of 1881, were reinstated 3 years ago. And so now if you're black in London or Asian in London, you stand 10 times more chance than a white person of being stopped by the police. So as it, you know, so the way I look at it, it's the same story. Nothing has really fundamentally changed, Danny. You've got these poor people locked up in sink estates and in poor, deprived areas of London, just as they were in 1981. The whole idea of so-called multiculturalism, which is what they meant to be, which is that racism is not about, you know, an ideological kind of view of people, but that it's all about identity. It's a, in other words, racism is a psychological problem. So you've got to go see your shrink to get cured.
Well, isn't this is actually what the Prime Minister is talking about, right? About, you know, a sick, broken society, you know, which is sort
of
takes it off the political plane in terms of the distribution of resources and what people, opportunities people have, and sort of castigates the people themselves for lashing back, you know, in an assertion of, you know, in a sense, their own powerlessness, but standing up for their own dignity in a way, in these spectacles. I see it a constant, pattern here. And in fact, you'd be interested to know, in my blog today, I report, based on my own sources, Bill, you know, that the New York City police are now, as of this hour, I believe, beginning exercises on Randall's Island under the Triborough Bridge, with some cops playing rioters, to create and perfect their tactics, because they expect that something like this could happen here. And apparently a lot of the cities in America are very nervous about this because the underlying conditions, the incredible heat this summer, the lack of jobs, for young people, the lack of hope for so many people, losing their homes through foreclosures and the like, has created a social dynamite situation that nobody really wants to talk about.
What's interesting here, Danny, I'm in the middle of putting a piece together about it. The BBC has this page on their website, which is basically saying, it titles the page, "The Competing Arguments Used to Explain the Riots." Okay, this was yesterday, the 11th of August.
And so they're turning it into an academic seminar, huh? Okay, go ahead.
That's, I think, stretching it a bit far. But let me read off the 10 reasons that the BBC have decided are important, and then I'll make a comment on them. Reason one, welfare dependence. You'll be familiar with all of these terms. Welfare dependence, social exclusion, lack of fathers, spending cuts, weak policing, racism, gangster rap and culture, consumerism, opportunism, technology and social networking. Those are the 10 individual headings that they then seek advice of the pundits, professors of criminology and right-wing journalists by and large. But if you take those 10 reasons collectively, what do they spell? They spell capitalism. That all of the problems that we confront as a society, which our society is failing to confront, failing to deal with, the fact that these young people, when they see banksters ripping off the state, taking trillions of dollars of our money, of people's money, and as you said earlier on, you know, a bunch of thieves in Parliament who've been, you know, basically turn the place into a private political club where they can fiddle their expenses and do whatever they damn well please, etc. What kind of role model is this?
Well, you notice we had
we had
a survey here in America of people's attitudes towards the Congress. 82% of the 82% of the people found the whole place, you know, ready to be burnt to the ground, basically, not violently, but, you know, because they feel it's totally unrepresentative. 82 1%. And I think, you know, I mean, to watch Ed Miliband, who's a young man that I knew as a young man, Red Ed, as they call him, basically standing with Cameron in the parliament and saying, today we are all united on this, you know, horrible criminal offense. I mean, you make a point here about criminality that, according to his analysis, every criminal in towns across the land decided to go on a robbing spree at exactly the same time.
The thing is that I don't think, and this comes back to the whole what I believe to be, you know, we don't have jackboots under this kind of fascism. We have the media. They operate as a kind of media jackboots in terms of how they deal with these issues. And from day one, you've not seen a single attempt on TV at any kind of deep analysis of what caused these kinds of problems. A society where the state and the political class have no legitimacy. Everybody knows they're a bunch of thieves. And this includes those lefties as well who stand up in parliament, so-called lefties, and pontificate about this, that and the other, but actually don't do anything, really. It's a private club. And people look at that and they think to themselves, well, what the hell? You know, if this is the way our leaders behave, how the hell are we meant to behave?
You point out here that the BBC has informed the public that more than 90,000 people have signed an online petition calling for anyone convicted of taking part in the riots to lose any benefits they receive. Yeah. In other words, not only to be tried and convicted, the assumption is they're guilty anyway, right? But to have a loss of their benefits, essentially starve them to death, you know?
Yeah, but the point is there, if they are thrown in jail, okay, they're not going to get these benefits anyway. So, I mean, you know, the whole thing is this is a typical kind of middle-class, kind of small-minded, bigoted reaction to the lower orders. I mean, you know, this is because at the bottom line here, Danny, is that really what these characters are talking about on the BBC and so forth and in the mass media is they're talking about the lower orders. People who are effectively less than human, who they subsidize through their taxes. You know, it's actually what it is it's a divisive, an attempt to divide people and to just, if you like, throw them off the scent in terms of the real causes of our travails at the moment. It's an outrageous situation. And even, just as with Libya, even the left here, such as it is, has been caught up in this, condemning the violence and making all the usual kind of prognostications about this, that and the other, without looking at a society which, I mean, I think like a US society, is broke. It's broke in more than one sense.
Well, I mean, I only tasted some of this. You know, I lived in England for 2 years. I taught at the at the Brixton School of Building, you know, as a lecturer, you know, visiting lecturer, and, you know, met all these 15-year-old school leavers, black and white, you know, the old Cockney, you know, kids, basically, who I could barely understand. But, you know, these people are so estranged, so alienated from the society, so, you know, I guess in Jamaican term, downpressed, you know, what kind of hope did they have for their lives? Very little at age 14, you know, they've basically resigned, you know, to live in the streets, to work, you know, in an industry where their pay was minimal and the rest. And, you know, it was the sense of a class-based society, which we in America, of course, are totally classless. I remember a cartoon when I was growing up, Mary Worth in the New York Post, and one of the lines was, you know, somebody was lecturing, Mary Worth was lecturing a young student, said, the only classes we have in our country are in schools. Okay. So a total denial of anything like class. And now we see in this situation in England, this uprising, which, you know, has been associated more with, you know, Cairo or other places, and it was even more violent, more angry, more, you know, you know, destructive in terms of, you know, how many billions have been supposedly destroyed now?
Well, you know, this is actually quite interesting because I mentioned in passing, and it's something actually I should have expanded on in a piece, the actual impact and the effect of the uprisings in North Africa and the Middle East. And when you look at the media coverage of these riots and uprisings, whatever you want to call them, that is not mentioned at all. In fact, I'd go so far as to say it studiously avoided any kind of connection to events in the Middle East and North Africa.
Yeah, I mean, exactly, Bill. You know, this is why I was so impressed by some of the people in Wisconsin who were, you know, when they started protesting against the actions of the governor there, one of the slogans was, "We have to fight like an Egyptian." You know, an identity with the Arab Spring, but the Arab Spring was about creating democracy. What we see in England now, it seems to me, more hostility to democracy, more top-down repression. Bill, can you stay with us?
I differ with you there.
All right, let's pick that up in a second. Let's pick it up in a second because we have to take a little break. The number here is 888-874-4888 if you want to talk to Bill Bowles in London about what's happening there right now. Please do so. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector on News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We'll be back in a minute. Bill, I want you to hear, I know you're a great music fan, I want you to hear a little of the song, the theme song of my film Plunder. Here it is.
Your Honor, for many years I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold when Wall Street stepped into the fold. Congress paid off, workers laid off. Stanford, AIG, and Madoff. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops, and bank walking is AAA. Grandpa knows his 401k.
Well, I wanted Bill Bowles in London to hear some of this music here, this music of resistance on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, back in the second part of the program. We're being joined now as well by Max Wolf. Max, an economist, a market professional. He teaches at the New School. He and I are both regulars on Jesse Jackson's Sunday Keep Hope Alive radio program, which is heard... KeepHopeAliveRadio.com is heard on many different stations on Sunday morning. And I had asked him to come on. He only has a short period, but I like your comments on some of this as well, Bill, because, you know, we're talking about an economic crisis. You're saying capitalism is at basically the root of this uprising in London. Bill is in London, Max, and he's been writing about events there and critiquing both the media coverage and the government response to what's happening there. How do you see it, Max, this whole incredible uprising? You know, the British Chancellor of the Exchequer said, well, at least we haven't lost our AAA rating, said he. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think there might be a little bit of an apples and oranges issue there with the AAA sovereign debt rating versus the, you know, I don't know, triple A, meaning maybe the A's with the circle spray painted around them that are going up around London, which might stand for something else other than the credit rating, that particular A. I do think the United States faces a lot of the same social headwinds, the alienation and the disconnect. And, you know, part of the problem that societies often have is even if the people who rule and run various societies around the world don't like organized, coherent left alternatives, usually the hard way, everyone finds out that they don't like an anarchistic anger with no particular productive outlet. That's even worse because there's no one to bargain with and there's no clearly articulated alternative. There's just a lot of anger about the present. So if you're choosing between the two, even though it may be counterintuitive to a lot of folks, you might be significantly better off with an organized, articulated, productive alternative than a whole lot of people left behind by a society that's less and less inclusive in its prosperity and leaves people alienated while at the same time hopeless and disconnected, so that when they are finally fed up, when they do want to do something, they don't really have the first clue about how to go about doing it in a way that's productive.
Thoughts on that, Bill?
What we've seen, just as we saw in Egypt, for that matter, or Tunisia, or in other places far and wide, that they're not revolutions, they're insurrections. The revolution has yet to be initiated. What do people do? What do young people do? What do unemployed people do? What do poor people do when they have a government which bails out the billionaires? If you take, for example, the borough of Haringey in which Tottenham lives, it did up until recently have 18 youth clubs, assuming they're any good. 10 of those have been shut. Social welfare support for what is a very poor community and always has been cut by 75%. So here you've got people living in the midst of nothing, surrounded by immense wealth, if subjected, if you like, to immense wealth, to the point of which, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter what triggers it. Something triggered it, and they exploded. The real question for us as a society is, where do we go from here? Because clearly, you know, this is not going to stop just because they've all been labelled criminals and demonised. You know, it will happen again, and it will happen again and again and again until we make some fundamental transformation of society, which currently, you know, I think Tariq Ali was saying the other day in the piece that he wrote about causes and so forth, he said, look, you know, there is no political opposition in this country. We've got effectively de facto one-party state, with initially the Labour and the Tory essentially doing a kind of Tweedledee, Tweedledum act every 5 years, and now we're back to pre-World War I with a Liberal-Tory coalition. So in a sense, in every respect, we've gone backwards 100 years in this country. And like I say, until there's a real viable grassroots opposition to the mauling that we're taking as a society, I can only see it getting worse.
You know, Dr. King, Martin Luther King, coined a phrase called a quiet riot. In other words, people were rioting, but they weren't speaking out. They were just inside, you know, kind of imploding. And, you know, we've seen that. This is an issue that we talk about with Jesse Jackson all the time. How do you re-spark resistance to all of this when, people are so, in a sense, seduced by television, believe in the dominant values of the society, think things are getting better for them, until they discover they're not. Max, you've observed this. I mean, today in New York, I reported in my blog, you know, the New York City police are having riot training exercises on Randall's Island, and apparently across America, mayors and governors are worried about, you know, what's happening in London beginning to happen here, because the conditions are very much here for all of this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think part of the reason that you've seen renewed upset here, you can see in the stories coming out of Newark, New Jersey, which is usually, unfortunately, ahead of the curve in terms of social disturbance or being a good forecaster of what's going to come more broadly, which is you have an unusual situation here, right? Since the Second World War, actually since, say, before the Second World War, since the rise of Keynesian policy, which most people seem to have forgotten, we began increasing social spending in economic downturns, at least maintaining, usually increasing, including increasing public sector employment and increasing deployment of police and military officials. And the United States, even more in many regards than the UK, has actually been cutting policing levels, been cutting social programs, been cutting federal, state, and local employment into a severe recession. So, in other words, the policy apparatus that we're used to coming in there and trying to absorb some of the stress and smooth the downturn is actually becoming a major irritant and accelerator to all the kinds of social conditions that tend to produce outbursts and uprisings. And they're doing it while cutting the police in the sort of fervent ideological melee here that drives budget policy discussion. They're cutting the police when every indication from history and around the world is suggesting this couldn't possibly be the, you know, it's hard to imagine a worse time to.
You know, that's what Paul Krugman is writing about today in terms of economic policy, that, you know, Obama administration seems stuck on fighting, you know, debt and deficits when nobody's talking about creating jobs and trying to do something to turn this around through some sort of intervention. The other day, Max, I was at a Greek restaurant here in New York, and talking with the owner about what's happening in Greece, where there have certainly been a lot of protests, as there has been in Spain and Italy.
Huge, yeah.
You know, and he was saying, you people, referring to Americans, okay, you people have forgotten how to uprise, is how he put it, okay? And, you know, he says, that's the problem. It's your unions, you know, they're sold out, you know, et cetera and so forth. I mean, this is the owner of a Greek restaurant giving me a lecture on the need for Americans to fight back. And we just don't see it really happening. I mean, there's a little protest today at the Federal Reserve Bank downtown. There's going to be some other actions on Wall Street today at 4. But, you know, the question is, like, there doesn't seem to be a mass reaction to what's happening.
Even worse than that, right? I mean, it's almost 180 degrees. And its strength is certainly exaggerated and distorted by some media reporting. But one of the bizarrities of the last few years has been everyone else in the world, to the extent that they're out and organized in the street protesting against austerity measures, and the American Tea Party out in the streets protesting for austerity measures. So it would almost be better if we were just doing nothing, but we seem to have a small group of very excited people who are out there with a vision of how to make a bad situation yet worse.
Could I interject here? Because I think that to me, the one fundamental kind of issue which I think is at the core of all this is privatization. That under the guise of austerity, under the guise of paying off the debts to the banksters and etc., they're privatizing what has formerly been, you know, even under a capitalist system, effectively social ownership of one kind or another, whether it be the National Health Service or education or social benefits and so on and so on and so forth. They're privatizing all of these things. They're privatizing prisons, just like they've done in the United States. In other words, crime becomes a business, not just simply for the criminals, but for the state itself and for big business. So there's a whole ideological kind of component to this whole struggle, which I think, you know, it's an attempt at the completion of what Thatcher started in 1979, and that is to tear down everything that we've gained over the last 100 years, or if not longer, and hand it all over to the big fat guys, and we as a society now, we've deindustrialized, so that there is no hope for any real jobs for the future of this country. They've all been exported abroad.
When we were in London, Bill, you were giving me a number which was shocked me: the number of people who are dependent on public employment in the United Kingdom. What was that figure, the statistic?
The state is the single biggest employer in this country. It's something like 5 million people, if I remember rightly. And critically, and those also, the aside from the transport workers' union and so forth, they are the biggest unions in the country. So in a sense, they're caught between a rock and a hard place, because their employer is the state, you know, and so therefore their jobs depend upon the state, and so far their response, I mean, has been abysmal. We've had one major demonstration by the organized trade union movement in this country a couple of months ago, and that's been it.
Here in America,
pulled over and played dead. Sorry, what was that?
Here in New York, I mean, Verizon employees are out. And yesterday, it was reported in the Washington Post that the Postal Service wants to lay off 20% of its employees and take medical benefits away from the rest of them. Okay.
Yeah, I read that.
At the same time, you know, that the executives of this privatized Postal Service, which is what it is now, pay themselves, as do Verizon executives, very handsomely indeed. So the disconnect between the workers and the CEOs seems to be growing.
Hey, is this, well, I mean, is it lack of trade unions, the destruction of the trade unions that does it?
Or is, well, if you go through the unionization numbers in the United States, they're not as different as you might expect from some of the type of profiles you're more traditionally seeing out of Western Europe.
I mean, but this is one of the points Max has made consistently, that workers, in a sense, in America haven't gotten a raise since the 1970s. In other words, with all this great progress that we're all making, people seem to be working harder than ever for less. Is it true, Max?
Yeah, I mean, if you do the numbers, if you adjust for inflation, and that's, by the way, using the official CPI, the Consumer Price Index inflation measure, which is quite dubious and almost certainly systematically undercounts inflation in the United States. But if you measure for inflation, the average American worker is getting a little bit less per week or per hour than they were in 1975 when the wages peaked out here. If you look on the other hand, more than about 55% of all Americans who are in a union at all, and only about 9% of America's unionized, but of the roughly 15 million Americans who are in unions, 8 of the 15 million, more than half, work in the public sector, federal, state, and local, where they're a third. So a third of federal, state, and local workers are in a union. About 8% of the American private sector is in a union, so 92% not.
Yeah, the figures are kind of comparable here. I think the height of trade union membership, which is probably the early 60s or mid-60s, something near to 50% of working people were in trade unions. That figure today, I think, is probably less than 15%. So, you know, we, as a class, we have no clout. It's as simple as that. If we had clout and were able to muster people to resist these cuts, to get, take to the streets, then perhaps we'd stand a chance. But right now, we're effectively defenseless.
You know, how does all this, Max, just play into the other news we've been reading, you know, in the last week, the downgrade of the United States credit to the degree that it really has been downgraded, the market zigzagging, as the New York Times put it, you know, up one day, down the next, and the rest. Are any of these deeper structural problems part of what's happening, even though they're not being discussed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the easy way to make sense of the recent equity market turbulence, or the way I would lay it out, is the following. For the last 2.5 to 3 years, kind of bittersweet, ironically, coinciding with the Obama administration, even though I don't believe it's particularly them that are responsible, we've seen one of the largest upward wealth redistributions in the history of the world. So we've seen the total social wealth of this country massively, rapidly upward redistributed. One of the forms this has taken is that the equity markets, you know, basic public stock markets and bond markets, have done more or less fabulously well. They have actually had a recovery. The macro economy here, not so much. So an easy sort of snapshot example is the lows for the equity markets were March 2009. So between March 2009 and, let's say, about March 2011, spring of 2009 to spring of this year, 2011, the basic price of financial assets doubled, went up by 100%.
Wow.
The employment stayed below where it was in 2007 and 2008. House prices are down 35% on average. So the average American's income is stagnant to slightly down. Unemployment is up. Duration of unemployment is up. Benefits to the unemployed are not up. And the only asset the average American who's not quite wealthy would ever own, if any at all, would be a house. It's lost a third of its value. So the basic economy never came out of a recession, although the overall numbers did improve, and the asset markets did very, very well. So going into about July, when we saw global asset prices fall off a cliff, for a lot of reasons, you had a weird disconnect where the macro economies of the Western countries had not really recovered, were kind of wheezing in an anemic recovery, which most people would have to read in a newspaper to know there was a recovery because it's not part of their everyday life. So there had been a disconnect between asset prices and macro performance, and that meant, of course, that either the macro economy would have to turn up or asset prices would have to turn down. While everyone was sort of waiting with suspended disbelief for something to happen, the macro economy fell yet further, and all of a sudden the asset markets are caught playing catch-up. So they fall quite aggressively because they can move fast compared to a macro economy because they were already soaring way ahead of what was sustainable in the macro economy, and then the macro economy turned down yet further. And then, as is normally the case with vicious cycles, when the markets turn down, it puts further downward pressure on the macro economy.
Well, what can the government do? What should they be doing? What should we be demanding in this period?
I think we need to step back off the ideologically leaden debates of the 1970s, admit the world has changed, and have a new proposal. Part of the proposal problem we get is we get into this weird kind of hackneyed old debate between worrying about budgets and worrying about social programs. They're not actually mutually exclusive. If we want to tackle our budget problem, some of the biggest things we could do would also make the society more progressive. Somehow, no one ever mentions this. What do I mean? You could start to have wealth taxes, and you could have real graduated income tax and a real minimum wage structure. So if you tax higher income earners at a higher rate and make sure to effectively collect taxes from them, you actually reduce the inequality in the society while helping this government balance its books. The other thing you can begin to offload is this kind of insane and overdone battle between liberals and conservatives, where everything the government does and conservative eyes is terrible and wicked and backward, and everything done by a government is seen as wonderful and progressive by a segment of the liberal community. Neither is the case. So what you'd want to do is look at what governments do well and poorly and look at trying to balance your budget deficit, if that is a priority, and for some states it really has to be, and doing it in a way that actually increases the progressivity of wealth and income distribution as opposed to increasing the regressivity. And we don't even hear that as one of the options in the debate from either the center or the right, which is usually the political spectrum here. And so you don't even begin to open the door to a discussion of what are viable ways forward that are consistent with our morality, what we need for economic growth, and also what we need to do to budget to start to budget better in a seriously imbalanced environment.
Well, you've heard it here, folks. You're hearing it here right now on News Dissector Radio, some serious proposals about what might be done, what could be done, but it seems like, once again, it's not going to get done unless there's what's called a little motion on the ocean. You know, it's not the ship that makes the waves, it's the motion on the ocean. People have to be out there demanding all of this, and unfortunately what we're seeing, is politicians that have lost the respect of 82% of the American people, Democrats and Republicans, a media which is hopelessly stuck, in old formula coverage, which doesn't really look at these things in any kind of new way, and this is one of the problems. From your perspective, Bill, someone who's lived in this country, lived in South Africa, is back in England for many, many years. What is your take on this? How do you, you're a socialist, I guess, or certainly an anti-imperialist. How do you see moving forward, briefly?
Well, it's really, what Max says about, essentially reintroducing Keynesian economics in order to save capitalism. I don't see it as being on the cards. I mean, we did it in 1945. A kind of quasi-Keynesian approach was taken by Roosevelt in the 30s with the New Deal and everything. But clearly, in the long run, as we saw by the time we reached the 1970s, there's a paradox, a contradiction between what is a dying capitalism, in my opinion, and the idea of having a welfare state, a Keynesian run state. Because clearly the reason
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say The reason that the Keynesian economics was introduced after World War II in most European countries, and to a degree, obviously, aversion in the United States, was, in my opinion anyway, to stave off revolution. In order to save capitalism, they had to introduce a whole range of what are effectively socialist measures, like national health service and so on and so on and so forth. What are the chances of these things ever being introduced again?
Well, you know, we're not going to be able to assess that because we're running out of time. I just want to give Max a final little hit here. You know, you're exposed to the dynamism of capitalism when it is being dynamic. I mean, you know investors, you know people in the markets, you hear how they see things coming, you see a lot of them doing very, very well. How do you respond to what Bill is saying, briefly, and then we have to wrap up?
Yeah, I would agree with Bill largely. I mean, Keynesianism's major weak spot, its Achilles heel, if you will, and there are several, but one of its leading Achilles heels was always its politics. But it is ironic that we seem to have forgotten. There's a social discussion about social welfare programs that forgets that they're not done out of some moral desire to be good to people who are disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm.
They're done
mm-hmm.
to keep the society from having the kind of thing we all watched on TV every night in London last week. And that if you forget that and you think it's just charity and it's expensive and you don't need it, or these people don't deserve it, or whatever morality, 19th century morality argument you make, you forget that it was the way this system could go forward without constant destabilizing violence and tumult, which among other things markets don't like and which kills business. Because you can't really do business in an environment of fear and danger and property damage and mutual suspicion if it reaches a certain point. And so we've reached this sort of reductio ad absurdum of market fundamentalism, where each time the market turns down, we decide more of the same will bail us out. And at some point, that level of excess, wallowing in the past mistake as a solution to the future challenge, creates an impassable situation. I don't think we're there yet, but I worry that if we don't switch courses, we're undertaking a social experiment akin to looking for the mines in a minefield by walking around stomping the ground.
Well, Max Wolf, eloquent as ever. Bill, eloquent as ever. Bill, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, they can visit my website, williambowles.info. No www. They can click on a link there if they want to talk to me, or they can respond to one of the articles
well,
on
listen,
the site.
Well, listen, both of you guys were brilliant. What a discussion.
You both.
It was a really exciting discussion. I didn't really expect that it would go on this way, but we let it go because it was really kicking some butt here in the USA, and I really appreciate, Bill, you taking the time to join us. Bill Bowles,
no problem.
williambowles.info, Max Wolf, who's a legend in my mind, anyway, as a brilliant analyst of the economy. You can reach me at dissector@mediachannel.org, dissector@mediachannel.org. My blog is at newsdissector.com. The film Plunder is at Plunder, thecrimeofourtime.com. That's also the name of my latest book, The Crime of Our Time. So that's some information for you. Thank you for joining us today again on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. And we have to leave you now today, 4 o'clock. Once again, as Kat told us, there's a protest at the Federal Reserve Bank here in New York, downtown near Wall Street. It might be worth checking out. And we'll be back next week, same time, same station. Thank you. See you later.
I wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a
40% of the stations carried no news of the world.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans?